We get live right now, man. It's going down, excited for the season. You know, we coming off a playoff win. I mean, you know, we had a couple wins.
Hello and welcome to episode 161 of Dear Diaries, a Milwaukee Bucks podcast. I'm Riley Feldman, one of your usual co-hosts, a member of Brew Hoop. Kyle's out this week. If you hear my voice, you know that Adam's already been retired, but he didn't go too far. I have Adam here with me this week, co-managing editor emeritus of Brew Hoop, and now making his first debut since the podcast was rebranded after the rebrand. Van Fayaz is on, managing editor of Brew Hoop. Gentlemen, how are we doing this evening?
Doing just fine. How about you guys?
Doing as well as I can. We got to figure out some shorthand for you to not have to say any title for me, Riley. I think you could maybe just say me, co-managing
editor. Yeah, but I like
Meredith.
I like the gravitas of it, though. You know, it sounds.
Don't give up that emeritus title, man. That's like, talk to anyone who's been like faculty at a university or worked for a university. That's like that follows you. You get free parking and all kinds of good stuff from it.
Well, I appreciate you bestowing it upon me. Yeah, and all the perks that come along with it. Yeah,
absolutely. You'll always you got a spot right out front, man. Always.
You'll always have an account on Coral that you can use in comment from. Do you have SB Nation next to your name if you go into the comments?
They still do. Yeah, they still have. Okay. I know they do.
Don't.
They're still on the masthead and everything.
There are perks to the job, including having to come here each week and talk to me and Kyle and whoever else we happen to get on this clown show. Bucks 2-1 this week. We'll move right on to the games. The Bucks started the week against the Miami Heat, win 122-114. Everything, we're looking, the horizons brighten, things look good, title is, it's right down the way. And then we go to Toronto, we get absolutely pants, the Bucks lose that one 130-111. We get our first fire Adrian Griffin comments in the Brew Hoop. I believe it was in the game thread. I don't know which user it was. Apologies, but we did get our first fire Griffin. Does not matter where you went across the Bucks internet. There was a lot of serious talk about Adrian Griffin needing to be canned. And then we come back and then they win their first NBA Cup group stage game against the Knicks at home, 110-105. Balance is restored to the force. Adrian Griffin has us moving in the right direction, and he has my blind allegiance once more. But we'll talk about what I learned this week later. We'll start with you, Vance, since this is your first time on the podcast this season. What was one thing that you learned this past week in Bucks basketball world?
I know you're going to trampoline off this in a bit, but I think just looking at rookie head coach in a way that I didn't anticipate we'd be doing it. And that's really because he had to, Adrian Griffin had to start, a season with a team that really came together in the few weeks prior to it, like literally a week before training camp began on media day. All of a sudden you have the point guard that you had been operating with for 3 months of the offseason gone in his place, one of the great point guards of all time. I mean, that's certainly not a bad thing. It's a good problem to have, right? But the learning curve for a rookie head coach when you're also integrating like a new major piece into a team, like you're working with an incomplete team, it's really steep. It's a lot steeper than I expected, and I'm sure than Griffin expected too. I was thinking about this the other day. The last time that Bucks fans have had to deal with like a true rookie head coach, I want to say was Larry Krystowiak. Either Larry Krystowiak or Terry Porter. I'll have to look. If you correct me if I'm wrong.
Some of the great names of Bucks history.
Exactly.
Some of the greats. Hey,
Terry Porter, UW, Stevens Point, great. I don't think either of them were assistants prior to, maybe they were. But certainly every head coach who has been in Milwaukee after those guys had been, even Terry Stotts was head coach for I believe a year or two in Atlanta before he came and took over the Bucks. I'm looking right now. Terry Porter was for just one season after he retired, was an assistant in Sacramento, and then took over the head job in Milwaukee. So, you know, that's maybe even he was even less experienced than Griffin. And Chris Stoyak had actually coached. He was an assistant for 1 year with the Bucks, but he had actually coached, been a head coach in the NCAA at Montana prior to that, and was a head coach in the D League when it was the D League. Anyway, so we don't. This is a new. This is kind of new territory for Bucks fans, having to deal with a true rookie head coach who's really getting a feel for the job as he's doing it, learning on the fly. On top of that, this is not a situation like either of those guys, Chris Stoyak or Porter, came into. I mean, when Porter came in, the team was still decent. They had traded Ray Allen, of course, but you know, they were a playoff team that year, and they still had some they had some young pieces that they were like T.J. Ford and Michael Redd, of course, who was a burgeoning star. Chris Stoyak, he took over a team that had made the playoffs at least once under Terry Stotts, and had again a healthy Michael Redd and a young Andrew Bogut. Adrian Griffin has one of the two best players on earth. He has a Hall of Fame point guard who has just left a team he'd played for a decade and is really very motivated to win a championship. Then he has the other pieces of a core that has already won a championship, minus Drew Holiday, of course. And the team still wants to win a championship. The pressure is high. The pressure became, it got lower once Giannis, certainly when the Dame trade happened. I think maybe it lowered the pressure on him a little bit, because it lowered the pressure of like really competing, I think, in year one to try to get a championship to make Giannis re-sign on the deadline. And then he did everybody a solid, but maybe he did the biggest solid overall for Griffin by extending. So it's not as high a pressure situation as it was looking like coming into the season. However, it's still a high pressure situation, and he's having to, on the job, figure out how to run a team like especially. I think the biggest thing that I've noticed is just getting these two superstars to play together. I was listening to Zach Lowe last week, and I believe there were just in that Toronto game, only 11 screens were set by Giannis for Dame. There was another stat. Screens. Yeah. That's something Giannis. Yeah. People have been talking about that, you know, talking about how he set screens in that two-man action with Dame. There was a tweet from Louis Zatzman earlier this week just about how the Dame and Giannis combination ranked maybe like 61st or something like that in the NBA in terms of the amount of pick and roll plays, like total for any duo in the league, which, you know, we were expecting at the beginning of the season that would be bread and butter for the team. Now, as Zach Lowe was saying, there's some element of this when you're early in the season, like you might want to try other things out. You might not want to be like just spamming that right away. But I think we were all hoping to see a bit more of it. And I'm sure that Dame was expecting it as well coming here. So those two, you know, it's a work in progress, their chemistry together. The coach also has to, you know, be running those plays for them and getting those two in the right positions. That's pretty tricky for a first-time head coach dealing with the two, like, I mean, these two established stars and their egos, and trying to also establish other elements in the offense. But getting a central element to the offense, I think, is pretty important. Yeah, and I mean, I think what everyone likes to talk about with a rookie head coach, like everyone likes to point to Steve Kerr from his first year in Golden State, because he took over a team that had, you know, like two all stars at that point. One immediately became an MVP, and then they immediately won a championship for their first year, and then they won two in the following three seasons. That team was already kind of together. There was a core there. Draymond Green was arising into it. Andre Iguodala was already there. That's not the situation we have here, and there isn't that that background that the Stars have together. So I think I undersold that coming into this season, how tricky it was going to be for Griffin to do that, especially like from an offensive perspective. The defense got the attention this week, but yeah, that's the big takeaway I had from this week, just like how that's going to take some time, and just it's kind of an impossible task for someone who's that inexperienced.
And you're spot on. I think looking at it, the loss of Drew, I'm not saying that Drew being here would make this defense function exactly like Griffin would expect, because I don't think that's the case. But now we have Lillard, who there will be a piece on the Monday morning media roundup from CBS Sports. A guy went through some of the efforts that Lillard is putting out there on defense is not great. And when you combine him with Malik Beasley, who has a little bit more want to, but he can't fight through it. I haven't seen him fight through a single screen competently, and he's just not coordinated enough. So now you have two guys on the perimeter who are actively awful or actively hurting, and then you're scrambling. So all of that compounds. You have that issue. So you're completely right, Van. Think about the fact that Griffin probably plans around having Holiday as, okay, this is going to be the guy on the perimeter. That's a good start. It makes more sense with what he was trying to do. And then also on offense, we don't know how all the details about Terry Stotts leaving, but the idea of still being Stotts would help kind of guide a little bit of the offense. I think the idea of Stotts would just be the offense coordinator, like, okay, we're on offense, Griffin's this down and Stotts stands up. That's not how it was ever going to go, but he could help make the conceptual ideas of what they're trying to do link maybe a little bit better, because he knows how Dame would work off of guys. He leaves, and now Griffin, who probably has his own ideas of how to run an offense.
Now was he that a purposeful throat clearing there?
No, it wasn't. No.
This is really funny. You're like, running an offense. Like, I expected some air quotes.
That was not there. I'm not trying to disrespect Adrian Griffin. Adrian, we love you on this podcast, and we always have. It's just he has to now try and manage both sides, because if his lead assistant offensive guru is Joe Prunty, I mean, you know. All respect to Joe. I can't wait to see his interim head coach next. Yeah, I will get his coach's jersey when the time comes when he becomes interim head coach. But it's just there's a lot of moving parts that we're trying to like catch up now on the fly, even more than we already would have had it just been acquiring Dame. Like there's way more components on. So totally right, Van. It's not necessarily all Griffin. There's just a lot of different factors going on outside of it that he has to try and control for. Which will lead a little bit into my what we learned. But Adam, if you have thoughts on it, go ahead.
Well, I was trying to think of, as you were talking about first-time head coaches, you think about ones that are under this type of pressure, like Spoelstra, maybe, back in the day when they had the Heatles together. Like, that ended up well for him, obviously.
And they tried to fire him, too. The players tried to fire him midseason as well.
David Blatt. That didn't go as well for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Yeah. That didn't go as well for him. And then I guess Ty Lue, I think, took over mid-season. Is that right? So that, David, that was Blatt, also first time head coach. Yep. That also would have been a difficult situation. Ime Udoka, not nearly the same, I would say, in terms of pressure and or roster talent, but also had pretty choppy start to his tenure as a Celtic. Those are kind of the sunny side things. And I think also, like Van was saying, probably didn't think enough about all of the kind of struggles that are going to go into that. On the Friday night Knicks broadcast, they were talking about how Griffin had just said 3 months ago his head was absolutely swimming. And now think about that. He's like, I feel much more calm now. But Dave just joined the team a month ago. So the idea of having to navigate all of that kind of stuff, and we have a decent record of some head coaches who have gone on to success, but there were a lot of struggles along the way for all of those teams that I just listed off that had teams with the caliber and championship aspirations. So you know, I think it's going to be a rocky ride, and we've already kind of seen a microcosm of that in just the first week and a half here.
Yeah. Griffin was like, I didn't even know there were 3-point shots before I got here. And now, now I'm picking everything up as we go along. Terry was supposed to figure out that sort of stuff. And he's learning on the fly. What he's like, why are these guys shooting so far away from the basket? He's like, oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, one thing I remember, speaking of like Griffin, like, and just his defense, when he took over there, we interviewed someone from Raptors Republic about Griffin. Just, you know, we had some Q&A session with him, and a lot of people wanted to talk about the defense because Toronto's defense was kind of infamous, at least with Bucks fans, and just known around the league as, you know, this high energy, high effort system. I used those words purposefully, that generated tons of turnovers. Because they had a whole bunch of, as we like to talk about, you know, 6'8 guys, young 6'8 athletic guys with even longer wingspans. Obviously, the Bucks don't have players like that, and few teams do. And also, that Raptors defense, as people have said, like it wasn't very good after Marc Gasol left. And even in the first 2 years with Nick Nurse, and Griffin was there throughout all that time, the team, okay, so those years that Marc Gasol was there, that's maybe the analog we like to make for the current Bucks team with Brook Lopez. Those teams were still giving up tons of 3-point shots, kind of like the Bud era Bucks were. That's something we'll come back to later in this pod. But that was, how much of that was Adrian Griffin? Like, I think he had the reputation as a defensive coach for sure, but like, was that his scheme that Nurse was running? Was that something he brought with him from previous head coaching jobs? It was something, you know, they both were on. Was Griffin on Dwayne Casey's staff? I don't think he was, but Nick Nurse certainly was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember one of the things that our guy from Raptors Republic said was that he was thinking that maybe Griffin would dial it back a little bit in terms of like it's funny to think about now, but in terms of like the ball pressure and the amount of the amount of arms and legs going into passing lanes and just the help that we see, maybe was a Nurse thing. It's looking like that's more of a Griffin thing, and it's looking like, yeah, that probably that defense maybe was, he was kind of the main architect of that, as people thought.
Yeah, it's and I'll lead into mine, Adam, right away, because it's related to it, because we go into the Raptors game and get absolutely blown out. That was where the defense had really fell apart at the seams. Like, the Hawks game was bad. The Raptors game was a disaster when it comes to the way the defense was playing. The execution was horrible. The shots they were getting inside. I don't have the number in front of me, but the mismatch between points of the paint for the Raptors versus the Bucks was just like comically massive given the personnel on both sides of the ball. And then late into the game, just the number of open threes the Raptors were able to get. So they identified the scheme the Bucks were running. They killed it. They decimated them. Shout out to the bench guys, the deep bench guys, for making it even slightly respectable at the end for the final score. It was not as close as the final score indicates. We go into the Knicks game, and we see Brook Lopez is near the paint. That's a revolutionary concept. And it is revolutionary in the conception of what Adrian Griffin wants to do, because doing that is the first step back, or however you want, the first evolution, let's call it evolution. I want to say it's like positive progress in what Griffin wants to do, in that he has Brook near the paint. And yes, Jalen Brunson goes off for 45, but it makes a lot of those inside shots a lot more difficult for the Knicks. We get, I think it was a halftime interview. Was that the halftime interview where Griffin said, players came to me, I won't name names, but players came to me and said, hey, you should try having Brook near the paint some more. And he was like, you know, as a coach, it's part of my job as well to listen to these guys to adjust. You know, they know how they play together. And he did it. And I haven't looked around online. I'm sure there's some discourse like, oh, the coach shouldn't give in to the players. You got to be your decision's final, which is so, it's so stupid. I am so pro coaches listening into, especially with guys that he has not worked with previously. They're going to have insights, and it's a holistic learning process between him and the players. And if this is like the Eric Bledsoe defense against James Harden, where he like lobbies Bud, hey, let me defend him this specific way. And it goes great. And Bud says, okay, go for it. Like, I trust your instincts. And I believe it was Chud Butter Bacon, which I hate having to say out loud. So hopefully I don't have to, Mr. Butter Bacon, I don't have to say that too often. Mr. and Mrs.
Mr. Butter Bacon.
Yeah, there we go. But I believe the opponent percentage shots at the rim was 80% in the first four games. And in the next game, it dropped down to 54%, I believe. That's a pretty, I mean, obviously you don't need me to say it's a massive drop. That's a massive drop. I just think it's good to see adjustment this early. Does not mean he's going to scrap the system. I think there's going to be a lot of testing to find out the right lineups. And it also makes me wonder what's going to happen with the starting lineup, because I don't think Malik plus Dame is a sustainable combo if you're going to keep running that defense. But, you know, to me, we see the first adjustment. That's the big hurdle. Can this guy continue to adjust? And it works. We win. It's still a close game, but... it's a step in the right direction, trying to find a fusion between the two. So I thought that was what we learned, is that Griffin will adjust, which is a big plus for a first time head coach, I think.
I was just looking at some numbers here. It's kind of wild. I was looking at cleaning the glass. So they have this stat that's location effective field goal percentage. So basically like how many good shots are your opponents getting, meaning efficient shots at the rim and shots from three. And the Bucks actually lead the league in that statistic. So if our opponents were shooting an average percentage from those areas, the Bucks would have theoretically like the best defense in the league. But as we all know from watching these games, opponents are certainly not doing that, because the scrambling has led to open three-pointers, open shots at the rim, most notably, all of that kind of stuff. I thought it was interesting watching back. I didn't watch the Raptors game last, so I watched it back later, and I sort of assumed that it would be like one of the worst things I've ever seen on earth. I did think it wasn't great. But I think the you know, like you said, Riley, the cool thing about Griffin adjusting this early is that he's not, this was one of the things that many people had that was a complaint about Bud, his stubbornness, right? We wanted to see some change. Well, okay, here's a trait in Adrian Griffin that seems to address some issues that a lot of Bucks fans had with Bud. And I think the thing that I'm most interested to see now is how he weaves in some of his other concepts, not necessarily the ball pressure, but I think the liberal use of switching is something that we need to have practiced more and have different concepts thrown out there. So I'm intrigued to see what Griffin does as sort of his next evolution of the defense, as he's working the drop into this with Brooke and then moving on from there and seeing how he integrates these other players and how he changes his tactics based on who's in.
Yeah, I was looking for those numbers too. Some people might know this, but the Bucks right now, as per cleaning the glass, number one in the league in terms of the shots opponents are taking at the rim. Like, they're taking the fewest percentage of their shots at the rim.
Raise the banner, baby. 5%. Raise that banner.
That's right. Yeah. And you look at the other, like, you, Frank said this, Frank Madden said this on Lockdown Bucks this last week. The shot chart is pretty good. So, like I said, 22.5% of their shots at the rim. That's best in the league. In the mid-range, basically just everything between 4 feet and the three-point line, the Bucks, almost 40% of opponent shots are coming there. So like those are the lowest numbers in the league. Corner threes, 7.1%, that's seventh. Non-corner threes, 30.7, that's 26. But the three-pointers, 20%, 37.9%, and they're ranked 20th in the league in that. So, like, this is kind of what we're used to seeing, actually, these last few years. Ever since Bud took over, the real difference, though, is Bucks are last in the league in opponent accuracy. Opponents are making 75.3% shots of their shots at the rim, and that's after how well it went on Friday night, where the Knicks only hit 54%. Mm-hmm. But yeah, opponents are. Again, this is like not factoring in garbage time, but I actually think garbage time would make these numbers look better based on how those reserves were playing and making the games look a little more respectable in Toronto and versus the Hawks. But yes, in the restricted area within 4 feet, 67 of 89 is what opponents are shooting right now. So yeah, it, like the location effective field goal percentage, Bucks are doing great. But, like first in the league, but at the rim last. It's very strange.
Yeah, it's been, we've talked about it. We talked a little bit on last week's podcast. I think the question at that time was the Hawks game an aberration or is this the real uh-oh moment? You get through the Heat game, the Heat are down a couple of guys, and then the Raptors, it goes off the rails. And then you're like, okay, this is really sticking with this. And it was just, it's more bewildering to watch. The scrambling, I kind of get conceptually what they're trying to do. It's the really poor communication that has opened up so many easy baskets inside, either mismatches or just cutters or like just a little bit of off ball movements. And the Raptors were able to get inside. And that was the big concern. It's like, okay, we see this glaring weakness. What's going to be the move back? It ends up being Brooke, which makes sense. Fit the personnel to the scheme, not the other way around, unless you're trying to get John Horst to send Brooke Lopez out, which you're going to have to wait a while to do that anyhow. I think it's positive if we're getting opponents to shoot in the right places, quote unquote, things will come along. We're already kind of forcing the right profile. It's going to be the execution. And then I start wondering long term. I wrote in the mailbag piece, I don't think many of the top 10 guys in the rotation, what you would think like the mostly veteran rotation, are going to be cut out to really run Griffin's scheme the way he wants. So either he's going to have to force feed minutes to young guys who might physically be more capable of doing that, or we're going to have to dial it back a little bit, which Friday was a step in the right direction, but who knows how it sustains.
Question. I didn't notice this. I watched the Knicks game only this morning because I wasn't able to watch it live. But did either of you notice Brooke, speaking of communication, talking more? I mean, because the last several years, Lopez was, you know, the quarterback of the defense who was barking out assignments left and right, unless, you know, PJ Tucker was doing that in those brief period he was here. Was he doing that more on Friday night? I didn't notice if he was.
He was, and I think Lillard also spoke to it after the fact, like the level of communication, the reads that he's able to make just because he's so used to playing that role. He said it makes a huge difference on the perimeter because it's not like, okay, I'm out on the perimeter guarding shoulder to shoulder with Brooke Lopez. And like, it's a little bit, just the positioning is different, the angles and things. So I think he was more communicative. And in the Raptors game, you could tell a bit of the frustration coming off of Brooke because he was like, why the hell am I closing out on Jakob Poeltl, who's 16 feet from the basket? Now, it also, apparently guys are sick, so if guys aren't feeling well, all that going on top of that as well. But I think there's a certain level of Brooke intransigence on Brooke's part, like, what the hell?
He may have been sandbagging a bit.
He might have been a little bit. So, but I believe, yes, there was a bit more communication from Brooke in the next game in particular.
The other thing I wanted to mention, like Adam alluded to this just now, and I think Riley, you mentioned it at some point in the last week or so, like the base scheme of the defense, as Adam was saying, and well, as we've seen, like the base scheme of the defense seems to be like this switch heavy kind of thing, which the effortful defense, which like you said, most of the 10 guys at the top of the rotation aren't cut out for doing. Whereas the base scheme the last several years that the Bucks have had worked really well. It won them a championship. Now, maybe there were times when they should have, and they did at times during the title run, gone to a more switch heavy scheme. What do you think is the right mix of what Griffin has brought in as the base scheme so far, like what he maybe wants to do in a perfect world versus what he should do? Like in terms of like, what should be the main thing that they're doing? I think we know what that is. How much should they be doing it and how much should they be doing other stuff, including zone?
I'm going to leave that to Adam.
I still think this is me. I think they should be liberally trying some of the new stuff. I know it looked bad, but to me, I don't really need to have them play drop to know that they can play drop. Like I've watched that for 5 years under Bud. I think if the scheme that Griffin wants to run is technically going to work the way that he wants to run it. I have really strong doubts, but I know the only way that I could see it working is if there's much better communication among literally everyone on the defense. Like a defense that runs like that, you need everyone to be communicating with one another. Like you need reps to be able to get used to it. You need to know, okay, if Jay Crowder is on the guard and Damian Lillard is on the point guard and they're setting a screen for one another, are we definitely going to switch this? Or are you going to fight over it? All of that kind of stuff, et cetera. So I do think that there are going to be times in the playoffs where they need those reps of different schemes. So for me, I was pretty comfortable having them try something new. But I do think with Brook in there, it does make the most sense to still just kind of do drops. So, and I don't know, he could try some switching stuff out with him, or like switch 1 through 4 while Brook's still in the drop. I think that, you know, so for me, I'd lean more towards mixing stuff up than probably the majority of Bucks fans.
He had some nice moments in the Knicks game, switching on to guys like Jalen Brunson, or I think maybe Quentin Grimes, like guys who were penetrating towards the hoop. And he got a couple blocks off that too. He can do it, as we remember, like from Hibs defense on Chris Paul. He can do it. It's just not something you want to be doing with him all the time. And when he's been doing it, he's been doing it closer into the basket too.
I think I have two thoughts on this. One, we go back to the Jrue Holiday. Brook is a huge communicator. I remember when switching first came to the Bucks when Jrue arrived, Jrue was having to physically push guys to direct them. Like, this is how you switch. This is how we intelligently switch the defense. Dame is dying on screens or on the other end of the court a lot of the time. So this just, there's a drop off there. So you lose your main perimeter communicator. And then I also want to give it time to say, here's the defense for however long we have to keep our promise to Malik Beasley that he'll be a starter, a penciled in starter. And then when we're after that and we can say, okay, Malik, kick rocks at the bench, who's going to be the fill in after that? Because I seriously think that's going to have to happen. I don't see how the two, there's got to be give there. So I think I'd be curious to see who gets stepped up. If if Beasley needs rest.
If he goes to Belize.
Yeah.
They send him to the Belizean League.
Yeah. If he goes on a vacation mid-season, I'll be curious who fills in for him while he's on vacation. So that's kind of, you know, I agree with a lot of what Adam's saying. Experimented, this is the time to do it. But I think having the base defense just to start to keep things manageable, it benefits everybody. I don't see why you wouldn't do that personally, but.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I can chime in with what I learned, because I also really want to get both your takes on this, because I can't tell if I'm being a bad fan or overreacting, because I'm finding myself growing more frustrated than I can remember in the past when some of these Giannis offensive possessions that I'm seeing are just like turning into, why are you just tumbling into people here? Like, There was a play in the Knicks game where it was like him and Dame basically like 2-on-2 with, like, I think Mitchell Robinson and Julius Randle were the two defenders. And Giannis decides to like kind of dribble in, pause, not really give it to Dame at all. And then it eventually ends with Pat Connaughton turning the ball over. And I don't know, I'm finding myself growing a little bit frustrated with the learning curve, which is fine. I know it's going to take a while. And again, I think my point on this was also, I think it bodes well that right now my biggest question mark is, what is Giannis going to be doing offensively, and can he acclimate to it? But I also had moments in the Knicks game where I was thinking, what does it mean right now that I trust the Bobby Portis Dame short pick and roll more than I trust the Giannis Dame pick and roll at the moment? So I don't know. Van, am I overreacting? Am I getting too frustrated? Like, what have you thought of the early season Giannis stuff?
I think it was clear to me in game one, by probably the third, certainly fourth quarter, that I think Giannis is going to have to be the one who adjusts more than Damian Lillard coming into this team. I know what you mean about frustration. I think, like, I've generally over the years been the type of person has been like, okay, you know, Giannis, you can take some threes. Like, I think, you know, one or two a game. And I still
There's a reason why Van has not been a regular co-host on the podcast. This heretical take, just so everybody knows.
I'm saying one, maybe two. That's it.
Yeah, I agree.
And we have a new feature on the site this year about tracking. It's a tracking poll where we just ask about, you know, just general things throughout the season, get people's opinions, and keep tabs on them, like how well do you think that Adrian Griffin's doing, you think the Bucks can win the championship, etc., etc. And a question I asked this week, because I saw all kinds of stuff online in the comments, like Giannis should never be taking threes, just never, now that Damian Lillard is on the team, never. And Zach Lowe was saying something about this last week too. It's like, now that Damian Lillard is there, maybe cut that out. So there's a lot of these vanity three-point shots, right? And he hit a couple of them on Friday night. He was 3 for 3, and it's like, yeah, it's like you like it for the impact on the game, but then you think, oh god, mm-hmm. It's just going to get worse. 32% of respondents in our poll, about 240 people, 0 3-pointers, please, from Giannis. About 60% said one or two. Then apparently 13 Celtics or Sixers fans came and voted in the poll and said as many as he wants to take. So that's the most obvious frustrative thing that we see from Giannis, but that's something maybe no one's going to be able to do anything about, any coaches or anything. And look, if that's like the bad you have to take with the good of Giannis, it's okay. What's more important is, like I was talking about earlier, is just getting him to fit in with Dame and also with Chris Middleton, who, you know, isn't playing a whole lot yet, but I think the offense looks best when Chris Middleton is out there alongside, well, anybody, but certainly like Giannis and or Dame. So I think reacting strongly to the 3-point shots is like, it's totally understandable, but I think it's ultimately not as big a deal as, you know, seeing how he can play off ball alongside Dame and how he can screen especially. And frustration around that, I get. I think that's like, if that's what you're concerned about now, it makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that's a better thing for the Bucks, especially, to be scrutinizing right now.
I will note for the Giannis 3-point haters out there, including me, he's at a career high 40% on three so far this season. He's made 4 of 10.
Thanks to Friday.
Yeah, he was. Thank you, Knicks. And of course, he takes them when the game could not be tighter. And he's like, we'll just see. It's a 5-point game. He's like, it's true. Okay. They did. But it was a small one. It was like 5 points. He's like, this is the time to shoot. The 3 points or whatever. I'm just looking right now. Lowest assist percentage in his career since he was a sophomore in the league. He's at 18.3%. Last year, he was at 33.2%. His turnover percentage is, let's see, it's a career high 18.1%. Just forcing it a lot with the ball in his hands. He's always been...
Do you have his usage pulled up? What's his usage?
32.8%. Last year, it was 38.8%, which is a career high. Okay. Previous season, 34.9%. So
that's down about where it was, like, I think, in maybe his first or second MVP season. Like, it's a good spot for him to be in.
It's the exact same match to it going into the title season 2022 or 2020, 2021 as well. So it's pretty close within, like Van was saying, in that zone there. So it's not so much the fact that he, like, two things. One, him bringing the ball up the court still don't get that fully. I would like probably Dame doing it a little bit more, just because I think it encourages his worst habits of, he gets a slight read and he's like, oh, I think there's maybe a gap there. And then he dives head first into the paint. And then the other teams, as most teams have become adept at doing, try to get a couple of bodies in the way. So I don't like that, because I think it encourages his worst quick read and react habit. The other thing is probably the pick setting is what I would not worried about, but it's just, it's a skill that he's going to have to work on, because operating as a big man in space, as I was talking on last week's podcast, is just totally different. Brook Lopez did that for a large majority of his playing career until he Lakers and then into our area. Like, he a lot more traditional big man practice. Giannis has always been, even like from the kid days, been like, oh, you're kind of like a point forwardy guy. Like, yeah, he can set picks or whatever, but late in the Knicks game, Brook absolutely crushed, I don't know who it was, but a defender is trying to stay close to Lillard late in the game, and then he absolutely, or Chris, I should say, he was trying to free up Chris. He crushes the Knicks defender. I mean, the guy folds in half because he just does not expect Brook to be there for the pick. Giannis is never going to set something like that. But if we're going to get the right amount of space or force the right, like the wrong sort of decisions out of defenders, I think something, rather than just doing slips every single time. So I think he will come around. We also have to remember knee surgery. He only really started moving like a month and a half ago. It does seem like he's forcing it. I think Dame right now is doing a bit more deferring, like, okay, this is Giannis's team. This, you know, if Giannis brings the ball up, get the ball to Giannis, whatever, which is fine. But now I think Giannis also feels a bit of pressure, like, okay, now I have to essentially pay this off, like the amount of trust being put in me, and he's physically not there yet. Well, is this like something concerning throughout the whole season? I don't think so. But the trouble with, if his knee is kind of still recovering, trying to recover live in the middle of the season, just ask Chris Middleton how that goes. So that's what I'll be kind of keeping an eye on. I think he'll come good, but it's just a lot of skills he has to learn. And physically, he may still not be 100% either.
Cool.
But are you a believer still, Adam, or are you on the trade Giannis to get the guys for Griffin to make that scheme work kind of guy?
I mean, that guy made a great point. No, I'm still a believer. I did think it was interesting that Dame had fewer field goal attempts so far this season than Drew did last year. So I was a little surprised to see that, but we'll see. Maybe that'll pick up. Drew was playing a few more minutes, but I still thought Dame might be a little bit higher. So I think that's really the thing, is I'm like, I mean, you have a cheat code like right there. You could free up a couple possessions to go to him. So I think that's my main thing. But thank you. I think you both helped me rationalize it and feel like I'm in a better place.
Damian Lillard got traded to the Bucks. He's like, finally, some big men. He's like, all right, Bobby Portis is my main running mate, I guess. He's like, same as it's ever been. Everywhere I've been, every season in Portland, it's just some rando is my big man running mate. Okay. It works. I mean, Bob, you talk about good at slipping and moving in space. Bobby is A tier at that. So at least that's working. But yeah. Okay, cool. Well, we learned some good stuff, I think. Good stuff from Griffin this week. Well, bad stuff, and then maybe the sign of some good stuff. some neutral stuff with maybe trending in the right direction. And Giannis still down, but hopefully also moving the right direction. We'll move on to the second segment of the podcast, Buck the Host. I felt pretty good going into this because I didn't see any comments correcting the hosts on last week's post on Brewhoop.com, but Van thankfully has something to bring up to Buck the Host this week. To get things started, the inaugural Buck the Host.
That's right. I mean, it's not so much directed at you guys, but there was a question from a reader. I forget the exact question and like maybe what he was trying to get at, but he framed it in the sense, it was about like overall roster construction moving forward, trades and that sort of thing. And he made the point that the cupboard was bare. And I want to push back on that slightly, because it's right to an extent. That's correct. I mean, I just think that when we're looking at the Bucks moving forward, yes, it is true that the cupboard is completely bereft of first round draft picks to trade. That's the thing. There are some truths here. There's some incontrovertible truths. One, the Bucks cannot currently trade any of the first round picks. They are all either they've all been dealt to other teams, or other teams have swap rights to them. That will change after the 2024 NBA draft. Then they'll be able to trade the 2030 pick. But right now, everything is encumbered until then. Another truth, they don't really have any second round picks to trade. They do have Portland's second round pick coming up next year, which is actually, that's going to be a pretty good second round pick. It's probably going to be in the top of the second round. So that could actually make for a decent trade piece. But second round picks, I think most people recognize, are more valuable maybe as trade pieces because you can put a few of them together and get a rotation player. You know, you can put together as much as five and you can get a slightly used Jay Crowder. I was trying to think of a nice way to put Jay Crowder's status when he was coming to Milwaukee last year. Anyway, but second round picks, if you want to use them to actually draft someone, you can buy one, right? You can trade a one way off in the future and you can get one. Buying one to use as a trade piece is a little more difficult. So the Bucks don't have any draft picks to use as trade assets, but they do actually have draft choices. I mean, they have these swap rights are going to guarantee they still, because of the Seppian rule, are guaranteed to have draft picks in the even numbered years coming up, including 2024. Of course, we don't know where they're going to end up because let's see, Portland has one now, one of these swap rights. New Orleans still has at least one, and New York has one too. As far as all those teams, like if they're going to be finishing better than the Bucks in the next 6 years, you know, depending on when, like I would think like New Orleans in the next couple of years, that's probably pretty safe that the Bucks will draft higher than them. But by the time, you know, we get to the latter part of the decade, it's harder to say. Regardless, they're going to be picking somewhere in the 20s in those years, and they will have someone, a rookie on those teams who will be under a rookie scale contract. And in the first year or two of that contract, like when these rookies are in the league, they are going to be decent trade pieces. I mean, you look at Marjon Beauchamp right now, who's in his second year. His value is really high right now. I mean,
it's maybe never high. Yes, I agree.
We'll see. I mean, players, even if they have like really marginal rookie seasons, unless there's something that has gone horrendously wrong or injuries, even after like a really like, just blah rookie season, they're still going to have some value as a trade piece. I mean, hell, even DJ Wilson in his third year was part of the deal to get PJ Tucker. So even a guy who's drafted 28th overall or whatever in his second season, if you don't know, we probably, most players, you don't know really what they are as an NBA player by that point, like the trade deadline of their rookie or their, certainly their rookie season, but their second season too. Either you know that they're like a stud and then you want to hold on to him, or another team would really like him and you could trade him away for a really good player, like an all-star player. Teams aren't going to really know who they are. And that, I mean, that's valuable. It's maybe not as valuable as a future first round pick, but it's like, it could be more valuable. I mean, if the player is actually really good, like if this, you know, if you're like the Raptors and you are able to draft Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby in the 20s, and that's like on the, you know, in like the 100th percentile of outcomes, and like usually you're going to end up with guys like Beauchamp, I think it's even like maybe that might even be like an above average outcome for a 20 something pick.
Value dropping live on the podcast, folks.
My overall point is that the Bucks will have young assets to trade through the life of this Giannis extension and a potential next extension, Dame's current contract. Basically, through the rest of this decade, they will have assets, young assets to trade that other people will want. So we shouldn't just write off the fact that they won't be able to get any stars after Chris Middleton is gone, Brooke Lopez is gone, whoever, Dame is retired. We shouldn't just write off the fact that they might not be able to get someone else just because they don't have first round picks to trade. And they will have first round picks to trade in the, you know, as the years go by, but they'll also have some players to trade too. So the cupboard might be bereft of draft picks, but I think they'll still have, we shouldn't just say like, there's no way they can trade to upgrade this team, because there's a way. That's all.
I like how Buck the host, the first time we utilize it is actually Buck the listeners and our readers. So I appreciate man coming on, turning that on.
I should, I should say that, like, I mean, I brought this up because, like, when Kyle was addressing this question, he did mention, like, well, the Bucks are going to have draft picks a bit, but I feel like we come at it a lot of times, and, like, when we're talking about it, it's like, well, they've kind of got their hands tied a bit, and, like, they do, but it's really not quite as dire as the complete lack of first-round picks to trade makes it seem. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad that Kyle did kind of come around to that eventually, but I feel like that's where we should lead.
My only follow-up question to you guys is did Marjon Beauchamp's draft stock, or trade stock, I should say, reach its peak when he did the ice cold veins celebration to put us up 45-35 in the second quarter against the Knicks? Is that the peak, or is there still more to come?
I saw him do the Sam Cassell big balls thing after Jay Crowder hit that three a few minutes, like in the a minute or two after that. I saw him do that.
I think Horst was ready to trade him for Dante back on the spot right after he did that celebration.
I love, there's the one thing about Marjon, he looks so self-satisfied every shot he makes. He'll like sort of stumble his way and he'll make a shot in the paint, and they'll like be flexing. I'm like, I mean, let's be honest, that was the lucky shot that it went in, but I appreciate that he has such high confidence in himself. Okay.
He's well, thanks not for, short of that at all.
Thank you for clarifying that. That is helpful because it is easy to be like, oh, 2030. But as time progresses as well, I mean, it continues to open up the time horizon as you go along. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Okay, on to Van's next segment here. Falling back or springing forward is the way that's that we're titling this. Yeah.
Yes.
In honor of
this today. The time loop. Earlier this morning in the U.S. and much of Europe, daylight savings time began, and of course we fall back, got an extra hour of sleep, but that's the whole kind of theme for this segment. I'm looking at just some early season trends on the team and among players, and what I want to know from you guys, it's like there's two parts to this. One, I want to know if the team or player is, you know, because of what's happening right now, are they falling back? Like, whether this is good or bad, are they falling back on their old ways? Are their skills dropping? Whatever, is this like from the past, or is this like something new? They're moving forward. They're advancing. And then the other part to the question is this just okay? In most of the United States, does daylight savings so. What I want to know is if this new, whatever's happening right now, is this something that it's going to be like this for a bit, good or bad? And maybe, you know, in the spring, like March, when we move the clocks forward, like then we look at it then and things are different, things look different. Or is it like Arizona and apparently Hawaii, who just don't observe daylight savings time? And this is just the way it is. This is just the way it is for now. So does that all make sense to you guys? I know it's kind of convoluted.
I'm going to need to hear a first question to understand to really get the premise to lock in. But Adam looks ready. So,
all right, let's start off with we'll start off with a player one. Pat Connaughton on the season. He's shooting 25% from deep, 4 of 16. He's 34.6 from the field. He's done a little bit better within the arc too. But is this Is he falling back or springing forward? Is this what's happening from now on, or is he like, is this just like,
is it temporary
or is it like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something that mm-hmm. we should expect heading forward. Okay.
Yes. Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Adam, go for it.
Absolutely temporary. There's no one I trust more than Pat Connaughton.
I knew you'd say that
as a role player. I mean, look, he got hit in the face.
I agree with you, by the way.
Which was great. And I just think, I don't know what he's going to look like all regular season, but to be honest, he looked pretty bad last regular season. And then he made like 40% of his three-pointers in the playoffs and was a key rotation player who you could absolutely trust. So for me, I think it's just temporary.
Riley?
I think it's temporary too. I'm not sure he'll hit the highs that he has previously, especially if the defense sticks the way it has. He's stuck out like a sore thumb, not for his own fault, but because a lot of pressure is getting heaped on his shoulders to cover a lot of ground that he just physically probably cannot do anymore. So if that dials back, I think we'll see an increase. So I think this is also temporary. And again, he essentially carried our carcass of a team in game four, game five. He was like, get on my back. We're winning the title. And he carried our stupid team. So he'll forever be minted until he shoots 15% from three in the playoffs. I will always assume he will play well in the playoffs for us. So I think it's temporary.
All right. Here's the next one. And this is a team-wide thing. The Bucks, their transition defense. They are giving up per clean the glass. 118.2 points per 100 possessions. That is 28th in league, only better than Indiana and Washington. Some other little numbers, off live rebounds, worst in the league. They're giving up 150 points per 100 possessions on that. And it's happening at the highest. That type of play is happening to them more than any other team, a transition off of a live rebound. So they're giving up so many points on that. Is that falling back or springing forward?
I kind of think it's here to stay. Ooh. If only because
it's like Arizona,
It is like Arizona. I don't know how much of it is an effort thing. I've never really played organized basketball, so I don't know what the emphasis on transition defense versus the way that you, your just base scheme. I don't even necessarily blame it on the base scheme because obviously he's having to transition and I haven't even had a chance. So with two guards who don't care enough to get back, or like, you know, Dame kind of jumps, sleeps, he tries to do an early trap or disrupt on whoever the rebounder is, and then he gets blown by. And then the rest of the guys, like if Giannis is in bad position, he's in the paint constantly. If he's not swishing home those threes, I think this is somewhat permanent, just given the personnel. I don't know if it's going to be this bad all year, but I do not expect it to be. Because I think, Adam, I had asked you a couple weeks ago, we were like about average most years under Bud in terms of transition defense. And I think with a personal downgrade in terms of defensive effort, I expect the transition defense to remain bad until games like really matter. I'll probably improve then. But
yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if there's like a small island that only does like half hours back as opposed to like a full hour, but I kind of feel like that's what this one will be, you know, like it can't be this bad, but I do think it may end up being something that we look back on and say, so this is kind of the rub with this team.
I'm gonna have to look up and see if there's any like Kiribati or like Tonga is doing. Maybe it's Belize. Hey, well, that's another. Speaking of Belize, that's another one I have here. Malik Beasley leads the Milwaukee Bucks in assists. Or I'm sorry, not in assists. Definitely not in assists.
I was gonna say, whoa. I'm sorry, no, Malik.
But it's almost as unbelievable in steals per game. He has now he had two steals in every game until this most recent one on Thursday night. So he's averaging 1.6 steals per game. Is this okay? Let me see if I can frame this sort of how I had in my head earlier. Is Malik springing forward, or is he falling back? Like, is he getting better because of this, or is he getting worse because of this? Is he springing forward or falling back? And is this like, again, here to stay like Arizona, or is this something we're going to have to just come back to in March and be like, all right, now it's different?
I think it actually hurts him a little bit because if he's trying to very aggressively go for the ball, I don't like that. I mean, it's fine if it's within what the scheme is trying to go for, but I don't necessarily, unless you're one of the few elite defensive guards, I don't want you hunting steals necessarily. And if the guy with the ball gets a step on him, I mean, it's a free shot right into the lane. So I think it's probably hurting him. But I expect it to stay because it's fitting within the conception of what Griffin wants to do. So I think it's negative, but it's here to stay.
I think it's the exact same way. I think part of the reason is he's pushing hard to get steals, and then that negatively affects his defense. Mm-hmm. I said whenever I was on the podcast last, I also don't have him in my playoff rotation, and I don't think he's going to be a part of the playoff rotation at all. So
the Bryn Forbes role it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. Marjan Beauchamp. Riley, I want to hear from you first.
Riley's guy.
Okay.
Don't say that.
We've seen him guard Tyrese Maxey, Trey Young, and Jalen Brunson. And varying levels of success on each, but one of the themes, especially with Trey Young, has been him committing personal fouls, being baited into it. 4.6 fouls per 36 minutes right now. That is actually, it's not leading the team. Campaign leads the team with nearly 6 per 36, but that ranks, let's see, among players who have played at least 60 minutes in the league right now, that's actually 30th among all players right now. So he's fouling a fair bit. He did not have any in that Toronto game at all, but he did get a couple whistles against Jalen Brunson. So Marjan as a defender, do you think that this is, you know, he's springing forward, he's actually getting better as a defender, and he's, by doing this, this is kind of helping him, or he's falling back and this is hurting him? And then again, is this here to stay, like Arizona, or will we be looking at this again in March and being like, hey, he really improved in that end?
I'm going to sound like a huge hypocrite because it's going to be like the opposite of Malik Beasley. So sorry, Malik, if you're listening, I know you're an avid listener of the podcast. I think it's maybe good for him specifically, if only because Marjan strikes me as a guy who floats, who could float a little bit mentality wise. So if Griffin saying, hey, get out there, get after it, foul, don't worry about it. And being, he also leaves Marjan in, like Marjan got those three fouls against Trey Young and Griffin just left him in there. And you know, we got blown the F out by the Hawks, so questionable, but he let him make the mistakes and here's your, like, your confidence. If we're going places, whether that be Marjan in a Magic uniform by February or part of the rotation, he's going to have to continue to learn. Like, his bread and butter is going to be the defense. If being more aggressive, being allowed to foul, make those mistakes, and also he's making fouls far away from the basket, and I don't know how many of it is shooting fouls, but it seems like it's stopping a possession from getting totally out of hand, like him getting blown past and the ball handler getting right to the lane for a kick out, whatever it is. So it's not necessarily dumb fouls, it's just too aggressive. I think that's okay for him, and I think it's going to stick too, because that fits, again, much like with Beasley, it fits within the scheme. I just think Marjan's defensive ceiling is a lot higher than Beasley's, for obvious reasons. So I think it's here to say, I think it's probably a good, hopefully it'll improve. It won't be 4+ fouls a night, but I wouldn't be surprised if it sticks around for a while.
I would love to disagree with Riley so that I could paint further my narrative of him as the Marjan Beauchamp guy, but I have to agree wholeheartedly. I think the thing that I couldn't help but notice every time I watched him defensively last year, I thought he didn't look anything like the kind of defensive disruptor that he seemed to be painted as coming out of the G League. And this year I feel like he's significantly better. And I think the aggressive play has probably helped him in some regard. I mean, that being said, it probably will be there to stay, and it's going to grind our gears if he's in the playoff rotation, because some of the ones that he was getting baited into against the Knicks were frustrating and all that kind of stuff. But I do think in the aggregate, it's a good thing for him and it's good to stay.
Cool. I've got one more for you guys, and it's about Giannis. It's about his shooting, but it's not about his free throw shooting or his 3-point shooting. It is about Giannis's his efforts at the rim. Right now, Giannis is, if the season ended today, career low 37.7% of his shots are coming at the rim within 3 feet. That would be the lowest of his career, and the only other time it was even approaching 40% was in 2021-22. And then 75.9% of his shots at the rim are falling. That would actually be his lowest since his first All-NBA season, not his first All-Star season, but the last season of Kidd, 2017-2018, when he shot over the season 75.6% at the rim. And of course, the next year he won the MVP, and the last three years it's been around or well above 80%. Giannis at the rim Is he springing forward or falling back? I think we know the answer to that. But this alludes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of his rust and not having a lot of build up into the season. Is this an Arizona type situation, or are we going to, you know, just get through the winter, and once we hit early March, the clocks will move forward and we'll be feeling better about everything?
Let's hear it, Adam. For this particular statistic, I think we will feel better after the winter. I there's some other stuff I'm not sure about, but I have to imagine that some things are going to clear up. He's going to find his way to the rim more. I'm sure right now he probably kind of wants to mess around. I don't blame him, because I think he needs to figure out how to get his mid-range jumper going at least a little bit, since I think that was the biggest difference between any of his other playoff runs and when the year we won the title, is he had that working to some degree. So I think he's going to end up stop messing around there quite so much and still be able to go back once the offense finds a little more rhythm back to the rim a little bit more often.
John Horst needs to open an investigation against Hakeem Olajuwon. What was happening in those closed gym sessions? Where what's going on here? That's what I'm curious about.
Could he be like the Rockets, get some hit with some tampering penalties for this? Yeah.
Giannis is just acting like crazy fool in practice, and Hakeem is like, good job, that's looking great. Things are looking great. I think Giannis is going to be fine. I hope it, at some point when the Dame Giannis, everything irons out, life should get easier for Giannis. I don't know why it's, how is it possible that we got Damian Lillard and it got harder for Giannis? This is the great mystery of the universe that we're going to have to figure out. But at some point, eventually, they'll figure it out. I'm not too worried about it. So it may take time, like we said, all the different factors, but I believe in these two figuring it out. It would be a true crime against Bucks fandom if we get these two players at their places in their career and they're totally incompetent together. That would be an amazing outcome. So I'm hoping against that.
God.
Oh boy. All right. Way to end on a happy note, Riley. Well, all right. We'll fall. Yeah. Well, we fell back at the end of that. Happy daylight savings, guys.
And then I believe we have here, I don't know if it was Blue in the uniform. Was that another fallback spring forward, or is that, did you just want to talk about Blue?
Looks like something that's just Kyle that Kyle put us into.
Oh, Kyle. Oh, geez. I thought, okay.
Our outline for us. Have fun. Kyle, it says.
What we're going to do is I want Kyle in. Do you guys have a strong, real quick, strong Blue NBA Cup take? Go for it. Otherwise, I will hear. I want Kyle to really lay into this when he's next on the pod.
I think I'll be curious to hear that. I mean, like, independent of the whole play-in, or not play-in, in-season tournament malarkey, I think the fact that the Bucks are using blue, which is an accent color, or as Kyle puts it, a side piece, they using that as a primary color in their city uniforms the last few years. One, born out of necessity a bit, because they can't use cream, thanks to the silly on-court ads, which I don't think I even see that much anymore. Just so it's done. Come on, NBA, let the Bucks wear cream. Cream is an awesome color. Like, figure your shit out with the on-court ads. Put them somewhere else. I don't care. No one cares. But blue, I think blue is cool to have as an alternate uniform color. There are some people around the Bucks blogo Twitter sphere who have some strong opinions about blue being a color that the Bucks use, because they're not a quote unquote blue team. But I don't see anything wrong with them using blue for a uniform that they're wearing once or twice a week. I kind of welcome it. I think that, you know, having it be like, it shouldn't be thought of as a main color for them, but having it be around like here and there, and even with this in-season tournament thing, I think that's fine. And I just don't think it's worth complaining about. Ultimately, they're just trying to sell jerseys, right? So, like, big deal. Let them make money. If people want to buy it, cool. You're helping pay the luxury tax.
I realize it's a good thing I'm retired because I genuinely had just couldn't care less about either of these things. I had zero feelings.
My the only thing I have an issue I'm probably is the color of green that they picked for this go around. It's really hard on the eyes. It's the court that they're using for the NBA Cup. Let's just call it that. It looks the best of all the 30 courts that they could have had. We got the best of them, so I am extremely thankful for that. But that mint green that's a tough combo. So, Van, you're muted right now.
There we go. Sorry. No, I don't understand the whole mint thing. I mean, it's electric, but I liked how Charlotte has been using mint the last few years as one of their like city uniform colors, because there is a mint in Charlotte where they make coins. It's like the first mint in the country or something like that. They can do that, but let's just stick with Hunter Green because it's been the Bucks color always. Doesn't really need to be anything else. So yeah, I agree.
Hey, Kyle, I hope you had as much fun listening to that as we did hearing Adam say he doesn't want to talk about it. So we'll move on here to the...
It's not that I don't want to talk. I just genuinely had nothing interesting to say. Sorry.
That's okay. Okay. We'll move on to the miscellaneous here. We'll start with rapid fire. Adam, I believe you have it ready for us this week.
Yes, I do. Okay. All right. A couple of softballs to start. After work, do you like to change out... If you wear a uniform or work clothes to work, do you like to change out of those work clothes or do you keep them on?
Yeah, I want to get my formal wear off as quick as possible. So, yes.
It's weird because I work remote some days and then I go into the office and I stopped caring a while ago. So I will wear like counterfeit Fear the Deer sweatshirts with jeans at work just because there's nobody there to correct me.
I should wear this at work.
You should.
It's good that we were talking about the Raptors this week and I wore this shirt today.
Yes.
For those who are listening on audio, my shirt says Drake sucks on it.
When I get home though, my wife constantly harangues me because I don't change out of jeans into shorts or anything. I just leave jeans on and for like most of the evening. And she says, what did she say? I have to figure out what exact term, but it was like the most misogynist thing about me was the fact that I wear jeans. And so I go to bed, like, I won't relax. What? It was something a lot. I can't remember if that's the exact term that she used. But so to answer your original question, Adam, no, I do not change right away, but I don't have like a formal uniform per se, so it's a little bit different for me.
Okay. I don't know how they add what. Okay.
Yeah, there isn't a way. There is
do you have a preferred shoe brand?
No. I'm bad with shoes. That's all.
I actually do. So I prefer, so I actually for all three types of wear, so Asics for working out, Vans for Vans for walking about, and then
I mean to say yes, I love Vans, sorry, that's my preferred shoe brand.
And then for dress shoes, I usually buy Aldo shoes because we're making that big money on the Dear Diary podcast, so those are my three preferred brands across shoe types.
Okay,
what if I was like Skechers
because
Julius Randle yeah.
Yeah, the way he was moving the other night, I had to go out to my Stride local Kohl's and snag some Skechers.
All right, next one. Okay, Adrian Griffin has been fired, and John Horst is picking has chosen you to take over. But his stipulation is you need to hire three assistants who have to have been Bucks in the last decade. They could still be playing basketball. Who are you hiring as your three assistants?
Sam Cassell. Wasn't
just
a Buck
the last decade. Decade. They have past to be a, have to have been decade. A Buck the last decade.
Oh. Okay. I wish this is hard. This is a hard one for rapid fire.
that's the conceit to the segment, thankfully. So.
Kendall Marshall is coming to mind right away. for no real good reason. So is Jared Bayless. I'm just like thinking of point guards.
Yeah.
I mean, how much do like assistant coaches really matter? Let's have someone in the, I think we need someone in the Taylor Jenkins, like holding back the bench role. And for that, I can think of no one better than Zaza Pachulia. So there you go. There's my three. That's a very that's like a 2015, 2014-15 Bucks centric kind of thing. And oh, Jared Dudley, he's an assistant coach with Jared. I think Dallas right now. So yeah.
So okay. Thanks for uncovering it. So I'll add Jared to it because he seems like a good guy and knows everything he's doing, and he is our assistant. So I would do Jared for sure, Jared Dudley. I would have picked Jeff Teague because he's very funny. He could have been like the intermediary, but he also on one of his podcasts said he like doesn't like talking to younger players. Like he just would like, you know, if they talk to him, cool, but he's not going to be like invite them out to like do things or whatever. So probably not Jeff. Sorry, Jeff. I know you're also a listener. And that's a way to just buy time while I think through guys who
you're already doing better than I am. So
is Brooke a crazy? Would Brooke be a crazy one in terms of like comms? He's changed his whole approach as a player. Like he's adaptable. He seems like a leader type. He's the key to a very functional defense for a long time. So maybe I'll put Brooke out there. And then I want to put for a guy who is hired to take my job when I'm fired 30 games in, I'm gonna put Giannis there so that he can also flail and then we can go down together and he can tarnish his legacy. But if I'm gonna get replaced, I might as well be the franchise icon. So I'll put Giannis as my assistant, and we're gonna go 0-30 to start the season, and it'll be glorious for everyone. So
do you guys think that Giannis will coach at one point? No. He seems to I mean he's holding these clipboards at the All-Star games and stuff like that, and he seems to like speak publicly about it. He's like, this is kind of fun. Do you think he'd ever do it? I'm starting to be able to see it.
He may think he will do it, but he will be a god awful coach. So I wish him he may love it at a certain level lower than like NBA I could see, but I don't see NBA coaching in Giannis's future. As much as I love the guy,
he's gonna coach the 2038 Wisconsin Herd.
Yeah, he's like, he's after just Bano, like a player I'm gonna retire after leading the Herd to glory for a decade and a half.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Beno Udrih will be the coach. He'll be the coach of the Bucks at that point.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, those were good. I was hoping someone would say like Mirotić or Bledsoe, but that's a little more chaos agency of me.
Jason Smith, how about him?
Yeah, that would have been fun.
DJ Wilson vibes. DJ Wilson, Rashad Vaughn, Deron Lamb, the big just dude. Yeah, we don't know nothing about being
Larry
NBA
Sanders.
Players, but
Larry
okay.
Sanders.
Yeah.
Larry Sanders and OJ Mayo.
Yeah,
That's a chaos team right there. That's a chaos staff.
Okay, last one. Who will win more games this football season, the Gophers or the Badgers, who are both sitting at 5-4?
This pains me to say this.
Oh no, we're gonna say this is good, Van. This is really good for me and you. We're gonna say the opposite answers right now. I have more faith in the Badgers.
I just like hate being really because I hate being on this podcast having to talk about the Golden Goofers with Riley Feldman.
They are the Goofers. It's true. Don't worry. Yep.
As you guys know, I have my druthers about Luke Fickell. I think I think the Gophers might. I actually think that, the Gophers will win the Big Ten West with like a really mediocre record and then get completely annihilated in the Big Ten title game. That's what I've been thinking.
Is Luke Fickell your quarterback? I haven't watched college football in so long.
He's the new coach. Okay. Yeah, formerly of Cincinnati and Ohio State. He's like an Ohio State lifer prior to that.
From what I've heard, our quarterback is a Greek guy who has not a fucking clue what he's doing. So I think we won.
Hey, give that like 7 years and that's going to go really well. You'll be winning championships.
Yeah.
He'll have MVPs and he'll have a movie made about him by Disney.
Yeah. And then he'll threaten to enter the transfer portal unless we upgrade everything around him.
And he never will. Yeah. He never will.
It's the Goofers. So even though it's the bad Jers. I'm going to put my faith in the Wisconsin bet. It's, I mean, neither team is going doing anything, so don't worry about it. But
what about you, Adam?
I was leaning Gophers, and it's awful to have to say.
Boy, I feel sick to my stomach. That's really bad in Wisconsin. My God, jeez.
I'm trying not to be too reactionary, but man, it was bad yesterday.
Another segment we are ending on a down note.
Yeah, we gotta, Riley, move us on.
Let's up the tone. Let's up the beat. Let's go to Germany. We're going abroad. Oh. We're going to a land of daisies and positivity. We're going to Germany on Van's Warped Tour, back yet again. Van, please take it away. What do you have for us this week?
It's been such a long time since we've been on the Warped Tour. Yes. Yes, Germany, it's lovely this time of year. But okay, this was a tune that just came into my headset listening to, I think it was just like more modern, like the electronic type, like electroacoustic type hip hop kind of stuff. Like, think like not EDM, but just like more like chill wave down tempo stuff, which maybe shares some elements with disco. And then this popped onto my shuffle through Spotify or YouTube or whatever. And I'm like, oh, cool. This is like a neat kind of throwback. This is like, oh, it sounds like a modern tune that like they're doing in the style of, you know, the late 70s. But no, this is a tune from the 1970s, the late 1970s, specifically 1979 or 78 was when it was released, called Rasputin. And yes, that is after the Russian advisor, the revolutionary, he wasn't a revolutionary, he was the advisor to the Tsar, right? Like in the
monk,
the
guy,
waning days,
personal
mystic
to the,
yes,
yeah, yes,
and
yes,
and yeah, lover of the queen. Yes,
lover
and
of the Russian queen, it's true. Yeah,
exactly. So it's by this group called Boney M, and maybe some of our like older listeners might just remember this song, but certainly they were, in the US, I think at least they were one hit wonder. A West German group featuring four established backing singers. Two were from Jamaica, and it was only three. Two were from Jamaica, and one was from Montserrat. Ended up in Germany, and a producer decided to form this group, to cut some disco records. And he then hired a male front man who, I wouldn't say it was a singer. This fella, who's no longer with us, was an Aruban exotic dancer. He was, he was entertaining ladies. And I've seen some videos of his moves back in the day. He could cut quite a rug. And he was the de facto lead singer, although he apparently didn't really ever sing. He couldn't really sing. He was lip syncing, yeah, and in the studio.
He's more
the
of a talker was, guy. Yeah.
Even in the studio, the producer was dubbing in what he would end up later lip syncing, and maybe it was credited to him, like in this song Rasputin. So, as Riley will attest to as well, it really does slap. But it is, it starts off with a nice, intro played on traditional Russian stringed instruments, balalaikas and domras, and then it drops into a really killing disco beat, and it goes into a whole story about the life and times of Georgi Rasputin, and how he was, you know, in with the Tsarina, and women were just infatuated with him because of his mysticism. Lyrics attest to this. Most people look at him with terror and with fear, but to Moscow chicks, he was such a lovely dear.
Bars.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Talked about how he was kind of the shadow ruler of Russia at the time, just undermining the Tsar. One of my favorite lyrics. He ruled the Russian land and never mind the Tsar, but the Kazachuk, he danced really wunderbar, because it's a German song after all. And how he kind of hoodwinked the queen to believe that he was this mystic who could cure the illness that the prince, her son, had. Then they talk about how, you know, the powers that be want, they tried to kill him, and they tried to poison him, but it didn't work. So they just like they tried poisoning him one night. He had no problems taking all of that, taking all of the cyanide or whatever that they'd slipped into his drink, and he because he was just this like absolute mountain of a man, so they just like capped the shit out of him, and then he was dead. So that's the song. It's about Rasputin, and it helped me learn a lot about Rasputin, who I'd only really known because there was a beer that was that like dirty Rasputin, that beer, I can't remember who makes that beer, and I just knew he had a beard. But yeah, the song is pretty fun. It's definitely of its time. It's definitely a relic. And the story of the group is kind of funny too. But yeah, that's my that was what was going through my ear holes this week. Rasputin, Boney M.
I would suggest listeners listen to the original and then the club mix, because the club mix takes it to a whole next level. The bass line is so thick it'll just break your jaw if you tried to bite on it. That bass line is crazy on that. I love it. And the thinking about Rasputin, like, that dude would have been such a beast in the paint. Like, if he had, if he had just different time, different place, this dude, he would have been killer. As like, he would have been.
I mean, who's his analog in the NBA, like in NBA history? Probably Shaq.
Yeah, probably. Or Sabonis the Elder. He was Sabonis before Sabonis was Sabonis. That's
for people Lithuanian. Yeah, Eastern Europe. That's a good one. Sabonis was the Rasputin of basketball. Arvidas Sabonis, not DeMarcus.
Yes, Arvidas. Yes, very good. It was another great stop on the tour. I would highly suggest people go listen. It's a great song. I have written here in the notes, absolute banger. And that's exactly true. So
I was glad. I was kind of hoping that you didn't know it, just because like you're a Deutschophile or whatever, you know, you speak some German, you like German stuff. And I've on this tour before, we've covered some other selections from Germany that you didn't know, but this one you did know. So I was a little disappointed, but I'm glad you could help me fill in the gaps a little bit.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. Beautiful song leading into a beautiful week of basketball ahead. We have 4 games on the docket. We're going to close it here with the weekly predictions. Bucks basketball, 3 of the 4 on the road starting tonight, Monday, when this podcast comes out. We're at the Nets. On Wednesday, they're back in Milwaukee to face the Pistons. They then head to Indiana the next day, back-to-back. They're at the Pacers on Thursday. And then they finish the week at the Magic on Saturday. Adam, predictions, what do you think they do this week?
I've got 2-2. Pacers transition is going to absolutely shred us. Nets, I'm a little iffy on, so we'll see how that goes. But I think they'll beat the Pistons and Magic. Keep working on through some stuff.
Dan?
I'm going to go 3-1. I think the Nets, based on, I haven't seen them yet this year, but I don't think they have quite the type of players that the Bucks are currently struggling with right now. I think they'll beat Detroit and Orlando, but yeah, I'll agree with Adam and say that they'll have a little trouble with the Pacers, although the Pacers defense right now is worse than the Bucks.
Horrible.
I want to make a prediction this week that we will see Chris Middleton. We will see him play 25 minutes in the game this week. I know that's like that doesn't sound that like
whoa.
I know. But there's been a lot of talk about him that like, oh, like because he played 16, 17, and 17. He's not playing back to backs. I don't think he'll play back to back this week. We played 21 on Friday, and He's this is kind of what the this is you're looking at last year. If you're looking at last year's when he came back from his at the beginning of the season, he was being thrown in there in the high 20s right away, 26 to 30 minutes. But then when he came back again in January, first three games, he was at 15 minutes. And then fourth game, 18, then 20 for three more games. It wasn't until a month after he came back that he was up. It wasn't until over a month after he's back, he was over 25 minutes. But after 3 weeks, he got up to, well, 2-3 weeks, he got up to 25 minutes. So I think by the end of this week, we might see him at 25 minutes. Because it looks like they're kind of bringing him in at the same schedule and rate that they were doing last January and February.
We give a shout out to Suki Hobson. Suki, we love you and all the work you do for the team. I think they will also go 3-1 this week. I think they will lose to the Pacers just because I think we're going to rest some guys. It's tough road, head off to the road and everything like that, even though the Pacers have horrible defense. I'm going to make a prediction that the best game of the week will be actually at the Magic. They have the second best defense in the league. That'll be really, and they have a Magic pretty mediocre fun. Offense. Yeah, so I think that'll be for the first time in, I mean, almost mind whatever, a long, long time, the Magic will be kind of fun to play against and actually somewhat competitive. So I think the Magic game will be one to watch. And I'm happy it's on a Saturday. Everybody get to watch it. So that'll be cool.
Future employer of Marjon Beauchamp.
Marjon's going to show out for John Hammond, who's going to write down Pierce and post a note trade for this guy. So.
Hey, Gary Harris is a dude I'd love the Bucks to acquire. You would fit in well with this current iteration of the team. So.
Joe Ingles too. Would love him.
Ah, Joe Ingles, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry, Don Vinci too. I don't believe in Joe Ingles as a future Milwaukee Buck. All right, wonderful. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Van. Thank you, Em, for being on. Enjoy the rest of the week of Bucks basketball. Always follow along over at Brew Hoop. We got the Monday morning media roundup. Van, can you run through all the different weekly? We have the Tuesday tracker, Wednesday weekly wrap up.
Yeah, so
run through all the Monday morning.
Still Monday morning media roundup from Riley. On Tuesdays, we're putting up a new tracking poll every week, the Tuesday tracker, we're calling it. Also that day, we will be soliciting every week questions from you readers and listeners for our weekly mailbag AMA type feature, which we are going to be calling Questions and Antlers. Hat tip to co-managing editor emeritus Mitchell Maurer for coming up with that one. Then Wednesday, the weekly Wednesday wrap-up that Adam used to do, Kyle is taking that over. Thursday, we have my weekly grades. And on Friday, we come out with the results of the tracking poll. And also, we have the results of the question, the antlers for your questions. Riley handled those last week, and Alex Skov will be doing those this week. And I'm excited for that because I'm working on getting some big names to come in and do little guest spots on there that you can ask questions to.
Yeah, very cool. So Bucks content throughout the week, game coverage and beyond, find it over at brewhoop.com. Send the podcast to people that you know that you think would like to listen to it, like Bucks basketball. We'd love to have them. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you guys again next week.